Scripture reading is going to be from Mark 15:33-39. When it was noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon. At 3 o'clock, Jesus cried out with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of the bystanders heard it, they said, "Listen, he is calling for Elijah." And someone ran, filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a stick, and gave it to him to drink, saying, "Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down." Then Jesus gave a loud cry and breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. When the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly, this man was God's son."
Let's all stand as our children make their way to Mr. Ike and take a moment and greet one another and welcome one another this morning. Find a visitor or a guest and say hello. Well, today we arrive at the conclusion of our study with the Gospel of Mark, and it collides in some ways sort of in a jarring way with the second Sunday of Advent. We are talking about "Come, O Emmanuel," and yet we're also talking about the death and resurrection of Jesus. But maybe there's a way for us to hear all of that in a way that speaks to us deeply, and a call to us to come, perhaps to think about it in a slightly different way, of our coming into the life of Jesus and what it means to follow him more clearly. We're at the top of the highlight of the whole story of the Gospel of Mark in Mark chapter 15 and 16. And like a good storyteller, Mark has foreshadowed all along the main threads of his theme. He announced it in the very beginning with the opening words of the gospel. The beginning of the gospel, God's Son, Jesus Christ. And with this announcement at the very beginning of things, he now keeps us, as we've gone through the Gospel of Mark, on point, point by point, highlighting for us sometimes in the secretive ways, the messianic secret, and on it's gone, to highlight that Jesus is, in fact, God's Son, that he is the Messiah, that he is the King that had been promised all along. However, there's been a lot of twists and turns along the way. And at every hand, we've been surprised at the way in which Jesus plays out his role as King. We've been amazed at all of this. And there have been times when we've been quite surprised, along with the disciples, about what it means for Jesus to come announcing the kingdom or the rule of God in our world. It looks different than what we might have expected. In fact, I would say that no king has ever took a more circuitous route to his throne than Jesus does. Our surprise at this revolution that Jesus is bringing is one that uproots hearts and not governmental systems. It twists at people's expectations by the way in which Jesus does not press to expel haughty Rome. Rather, he seeks to expel haughty religious practices and traditions. The turn that Jesus demands is a turn toward repentance and a change of heart. And so we've been stunned as we've gone along at Jesus' complete and utter devotion to God, to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And so our surprise here continues as we see the unfolding developments of these last chapters of the Gospel of Mark. Our gut begins to tighten as we begin to fear that Jesus' words and his deeds are going to get him killed. And that's the one thing that we're not surprised about. We're not surprised that Jesus ultimately finds himself on the dead of night being arrested in the lower grove or the lower heights of the Mount of Olives and a bunch of olive trees. We're not surprised by that because we know full well what it means to run amok of the way in which the world operates. You see, the world operates out of a notion that power is the thing that drives the world forward. That claiming power, in whatever way that you can claim it, is the way to which you find the end to that which you seek. And Jesus has gone at odds with the power structures that are in play in Judea, both with primarily with the Jewish practices that we find in the temple, and with the traditions that had been bound up and perpetuated by the Pharisees and the scribes. Also with Rome, we see this unfolding. We know this because we see how malevolent powers are at work in our own life and in our own world. That when we find ourselves trying to make our way in the world, the way we do it is by asserting ourselves in some way. Jesus takes another course. His path is one of relinquishment. His way of ordering the world seems completely at odds with everything that we see and witness in the ancient world of Rome, as well as the modern world of the global environment that we live in today. And so we cringe as we see this train wreck waiting to happen as Jesus and the Jewish leaders and the powers that be of Rome all collide in the tail end of chapter 14 and chapter 15, because Jesus does not play by the rules. He takes another kind of course of action. And so we're left with a question as we move into chapter 15 and 16. And that is, will the king that's been secretly announced and working out his agenda in such remarkable and upside-down sorts of ways be able to establish his kingdom? Will the kingdom of God that Jesus came announcing actually come to pass because he's about to get squeezed like a grape in the vise that you find between Roman leadership and the Jewish leadership? What will happen? Will Jesus be able to establish his kingdom? Will he bring to pass the thing that he wants to bring to pass? Because there is nothing here that gives rise to think that he can make it happen. And that's what we find in chapters 14, 15, and 16. First, it is the Jewish trial that we saw last week in the end of chapter 14. And now in chapter 15, we see the Romans go at it as well. And in both of those trial settings, we have the claim being made by Jesus that he is, in fact, either in the Jewish world, it is the Son of the Blessed One, that is to say, the Son of God, and in the Roman world, it is that he is the King of the Jews, the King of Israel. And so we have the testimony that's given by Jesus' own mouth, but how is this going to come to pass? How is it going to come to pass? And what we find in much of chapter 15 is the working out of the powers that be, the way the world works. Charles Darwin's theory of evolution, where the survival of the fittest is at work. It's as if there's a tug of war going on in chapter 15. We've got the Romans doing their thing, law and order. They're pulling on one end of the rope. And the Jewish leadership is pulling on the other end of the rope, both trying to assert their power over the people of Judea. And you know who the rope is, don't you? You see, it's Jesus that's being pulled taunter and taunter. And will he break? And what will happen? Well, what Mark intends for us to see in this tug of war, actually, is a coronation exercise. And it's actually quite consistent with what we've seen throughout the Gospel of Mark. It's a coronation exercise that takes place. Now, it's not like what you would see at Westminster Cathedral when some king or queen gets seated on the monarchy of England. It's not that kind of coronation. But that's what we've got. Because after Pilate gets through with Jesus and he is stripped of every piece of his clothing in public and flogged, as the text speaks of, the coronation begins. The King of the Jews is being crowned king. It's not the usual sort of adoring crowds that are there. It's a bunch of jeering soldiers who have finally been released to let their anger and frustration at these Jews that they have to live and work with, they let that frustration all loose on Jesus. They first play out this coronation exercise. They find a purple robe and throw it on him. They make a crown of thorns for him and stab it into his head. They take his scepter, a stick, and they whack him with it. Oh, they hail him as King of the Jews, even as they spit him on him. What we see Mark telling us is how Jesus comes to be king. And it doesn't look like what we see when Princess Diana walked down and Prince Charles and all the other kinds of glorious moments that we see when we think about monarchies. No, what we see ultimately is that Jesus finds his way to his throne, except his throne is not capped with gold and he sits comfortably on golden and purple cushions. No, his throne is one that he assumes the position of a man who is nailed to a cross. He's lifted up before us, complete with a title, a sign up above him that says, in irony, the King of the Jews. See, Mark is playing out all of this in remarkable ways. Pilate is wanting to play tug of war with the Jews and poke at them. See, here's your King of the Jews. But Mark tells us the story to echo for us the truth of what is being claimed. Here is our King stretched out on a cross. The whole thing climaxes in this telling of this story with these verses that Maureen read for us a few moments ago. All through this chapter, Mark has been playing with and riffing off of Psalm 22. At least three occasions, Psalm 22 is being quoted or paraphrased throughout this chapter. The most overt one of those that you probably recognize is here, when Jesus cries out, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, the Aramaic for, my God, why have you forsaken me? And with that cry and the few moments that follow, what we see happen is the exclamation point of the Gospel of Mark. We began with the confession that Jesus is the Christ, God's Son, in chapter 1, verse 1. It is spoken by Peter in chapter 8, in the middle of the Gospel. You are the Christ, he says. And now at the end of the Gospel, for all of Mark's congregation to hear as he writes this gospel out to early Christians, he has, ironically, you see, a Roman centurion, a military leader, give his report and confession. When the military leader says, truly, this man was the Son of God as he died. Now, there are a lot of things that could be said about this moment. A lot of scholars want to point out that the centurion is an intriguing figure to do this because the centurion was not unaccustomed to seeing people die. He knew how to put people to death. This centurion was a hardened individual, undoubtedly, and had seen a lot of people go to crosses. And there was something in the way in which Jesus died. There was something in the way in which Jesus embraced his coronation that struck this hardened military leader in a way that he makes this kind of exclamation. Now, some want to make the point, and rightfully so, that if you want to play out the Greek here, that there is no definitive article. It's not that Jesus, that the Roman centurion was saying, this is the Son of God, as you and I would make the claim. I know that. And Mark knew that. But Mark wants us to read it at multiple levels. He wants us to understand that in Jesus dying, even the powers that brought about his death, there was the recognition that this man was different. And to not mark that, we have a phrase being used, the Son of God, that was only used in the Roman world for emperors and kings. So here we are with this claim. And Mark is telling this story to his congregation to help them in their time of trial and crisis and struggle, to remind them of what it was that they had given their lives over to in the way of Jesus, to follow the way of Jesus, to embrace a path of living life that was characterized by the King. And here stands at the center of all of this, ironically, the cross. The cross. Why would you mark your kingdom with a cross? Unless, of course, the cross represents and symbolizes the way of the kingdom, which is, in fact, what we have seen Jesus say and teach all through the Gospel of Mark. That the way of Jesus, the way of the kingdom, is a path that is characterized by letting go of yourself. It is a path that is characterized by seeking the best needs of others, not yourself. It is a way of living life that is characterized by putting God and His will and purpose for life and your life first above all other things. It is a way of living that is characterized by almost everything in life being turned upside down to the way in which we normally work. Power asserting power against other power. That is why the cross is Jesus' coronation theme. It's the cross, the way of the cross. And it calls upon us in various ways to revision what it means to follow Jesus. The cross marks the way of the kingdom, a path of relinquishment and letting go. It marks for us the deep, undying love of God for you and I, that He was willing to sacrifice life in order that we might share in life. It characterizes for us our ethic, the way in which we live out our own life, a path of relinquishment and letting go. It's the cross. As we struggle and try to find our way through life, what we find being presented in the Gospel of Mark from chapter 1, verse 1, to chapter 16, verse wherever you want to end it, verse 7, I think, or the verse in which those women went out full of amazement and fear, that what we have being presented to us is a vision of what home really looks like. What security really looks like. What meaning really looks like. It looks like the cross. The cross. Now, I know that when we start talking about meaning and life and security, there have been some tendencies to think that that's something that we experience and hope for in the future. And so we put it out there in the future. You know, I hope someday to be home with God. But the way in which Mark writes this gospel, he doesn't give us the freedom to simply shoot it out in front of us. He wants us to understand that living the way of Jesus is something that means that we carry home or meaning or life or vitality right here in the present. Recently, I saw the movie that was made in, I think, 2002, starred Mel Gibson, that was based on a novel, or actually nonfiction piece, by Hal Moore and a reporter written in the early 90s about the first major battle in Vietnam, 1965. The book title and the movie title is We Were Soldiers and Young. The colonel in the story and the author of the book tells of a speech he made to his battalion before they left Fort Benning, Georgia, to go to Vietnam, knowing that they would probably be the spearhead of the first major American offensive in that war. And he says to his whole battalion and all the family gathered there this. He says, "We think that we're leaving home and going 12,000 miles away. But," he says, "in reality, we are home. and your brother, your neighbor, standing here in formation together, is your brother. We take home with us. There is this worldliness about what it means to embrace the cross for our lives. We are people who are shaped by the cross. We are redeemed by the blood of the cross. The nature of our life together is characterized by the shape of a cross. Our whole world, the way we see the world, is shaped by what the cross stands for as the King who does things the other way. The cross, then, it seems to me, is something that we need to bring front and center for ourselves, at least this morning, as we think about the close of the Gospel of Mark and the way in which it illuminates our life. There was a popular story told 100 years ago. It was in dozens and dozens of sermon illustrations. You still find it floating around on the internet. Even today, it's a story, I'm sure by now it's completely apocryphal, about a young little boy who is lost on the city streets of London. And he's found by a police officer. The boy's just crying, very tearful. He's lost, he can't find his way home. And then he says to the police officer, "If I can just find the cross." And what he meant by that was, if you've ever been to London, you know where Charing Cross is at. A major depot, train and subway depot, very major cross street in London. "If I can only find my way to the cross, then I can find my way home." Now, I don't know this for sure, but there are some indications that suggest that a young woman by the name of Jessie Brown Pons found or heard that story, and she wrote some poetry about that. And it got set to music about 100 years ago. And the lyrics for that, the poem, the lyrics, has come down to us. Perhaps some of you know those lyrics. If we understand what she's saying, I think that perhaps it reflects well what we're talking about today. She says these things: "I must needs go home by the way of the cross. There's no other path but this. I shall ne'er get sight of the gates of light if the way of the cross I miss." You know this song? Sing the chorus with me. "Oh, the way of the cross leads home. Oh, the way of the cross leads home. It is sweet to know, as I onward go, all the way of the cross leads home." Now she calls for a point of decision in another verse. And you know, I've sung this song a gazillion times. You have too, many of you have. I always heard it, the last stanza, this way: "When I bid farewell to the way of the world." But that's not what the text says. I think I've heard it in that way that I spoke of earlier, that the cross means something to something out there in the future. When I finally get through in this world, then I'll go on home to be with Jesus. That is not what Jessie Brown Pounds wanted to say. The text is, "Then I bid farewell," or "So I bid farewell." It is a commitment that we make to the cross today, for today, that she is speaking about. "Then I bid farewell to the way of the world, to walk can it nevermore? For my Lord says, come, and he makes his home where he waits at the open door. So the way of the cross leads home. Way of the cross leads home. It is sweet to know as I onward go. All the way of the cross leads home. Mark wrote this gospel to a congregation of people who were living in fear and wrestling with the calamity and upheaval of an uncertain time. His call to them was to say, remember the King. Remember the way of the cross. Relinquish yourself and follow after him. Take up your cross and follow him. And in so doing, we will find life. And so this morning, I'm inviting you to that ancient claim that Jesus is the King. You see, the centurion got it almost right. He was almost right. He didn't get it quite right. He said, surely, truly, this man was the Son of God. I'm here to say that truly, this man is the Son of God and bears witness to the power of his kingdom in this church and in people of God all over the world. And I'm inviting you to share in the joy of the way of the cross this morning. If we can help you in that walk, won't you come to the front now as we stand and sing?